Write that one down. S-A-B-E-L-L-I-A-N-I-S-M. We'll get around to it. Eustathius was accused, condemned, and deposed at a synod in Antioch. Keep coming up, don't it? The people of Antioch, always prone to disturbances, rebelled against this action, while the anti-Eustathians proposed Eusebius as the new bishop, but he declined. After Eustathius had been removed, let's just call him Jim Baker, the Eusebians proceeded against Athanasius, a much more dangerous opponent. In 334, he was summoned before a synod in Caesarea. He did not attend, however, distrusting his opponents. He's here out in Palm Springs. In the following year, he was again summoned before a synod in Tyre, at which Eusebius presided. Athanasius, divining the result, knowing it was a stacked deck, went to Constantinople to bring his cause before the emperor. The emperor called the bishops to his court, among them Eusebius. Athanasius was condemned when Eusebius showed up and exiled at the end of 335. Took his home away, too. At the same synod, another opponent was successfully attacked. Marcellus of Ancyra had long opposed the Eusebians and had only lately protested against the reinstitution of Arius. He was accused of Sabellianism. The church has always enjoyed getting these little cookie-cutter name tags that mean bad. Putting them on people. He was accused of Sabellianism. We're going to have to find out what that is. And deposed in the beginning of 336. I mean, my Lord, by 336, we've got to deal with that. Allogy? Not allergies. Allogy? We've got to deal with Montanism. We've got to deal with the Ebionites. We've got to deal with Arianism. We've got to deal with Gnosticism. We've got to deal with Marcionism. We've got to deal with Montanism. We've got to deal with Sabellianism. That'll give you a bellyache. Constantine died the next year, and Eusebius did not long survive him. Of the extensive literary activity of Eusebius, a relatively large portion has been preserved, although posterity suspected him of Arianism. Eusebius had made himself indispensable by his method of authorship. His comprehensive and careful excerpts from original sources saved his successors the painstaking labor of research. Also helps if you eliminate what you copied from, so yours is the only source now. Hence, much has been preserved which otherwise would have been destroyed. The literary productions of Eusebius reflect on the whole course of his life. At first, he occupied himself with works on biblical criticism. Under the influence of Pamphilus and probably of Dorotheus of the school of Antioch. Afterward, the persecutions under Diocletian and Galerius directed his attention to the martyrs of his own time and the past, and this led him to the history of the whole church and finally to the history of the world, which to him was only a preparation for ecclesiastical history. The Will Durant of his time. He had a philosophy of history, that world history was preparation for church history. Then followed the time of the Arian controversies, and dogmatic questions came into the foreground. Christianity at last found recognition with the state, and this brought new problems. Apologies of a different sort had to be prepared. Lastly, Eusebius, the court theologian, wrote eulogies in praise of the first, quote, Christian emperor. To all this activity must be added numerous writings of a miscellaneous nature, addresses, letters, and the like, and exegetical works, which include both commentaries and treatises on biblical archaeology and extend over the whole of his life. Pamphilus and Eusebius occupied themselves with the text criticism of the Old Testament, using the Septuagint, and especially of the New Testament. An edition of the Septuagint seems to have been already prepared by Origen, which, according to Jerome, was revised and circulated by Eusebius and Pamphilus. I wonder how they revised it. These are real buddies, aren't they? For an easier survey of the material of the four evangelists, the Gospels, Eusebius divided his edition of the New Testament into paragraphs and provided it with a synoptical table so that it might be easier to find the pericopes which belong together. The two greatest historical works of Eusebius are his Chronicle and his Church History. The former, Pantodare Historia, Universal History, is divided into two parts. The first part you're about the preacher that preached in French. The first part purports to give an epitome of universal history from the sources arranged according to nations. The second part attempts to furnish a synchronism of the historical material in parallel columns. The work as a whole has been lost in the original, but it may be reconstructed from later chronographists of the Byzantine school who made excerpts from the work with untiring diligence, especially Georgius and Sellus. The Byzantine school is another way of talking about the Eastern Roman Empire. The tables of the second part have been completely preserved in a Latin translation by Jerome, and on and on and on it goes. The Chronicle is preserved, extends to the year 325. It was written before the Church History. So he wrote World History under the title of the Chronicle, or History Universal, up to and including the year 325. What an ambitious project. And obviously, without the research materials that now are available in the ancient period. In his Church History, Eusebius attempted, according to his own declaration, here's his bias, to present the history of the church from the apostle to his own time, the apostles to his own time, with special regard to the following points. Here you're going to see his bias. The successions of bishops in principal sees, the principal cities, from apostolic time, the succession of the bishops, because it was suddenly becoming important to trace apostolic succession. 2, the history of Christian teachers. 3, the history of heresies. 4, the history of the Jews. I'm sure he was very objective there and fair. 5, the relations to the heathen. 6, the martyrdoms. Got to be something wrong with a guy that produces a church history in 6 groups. He grouped his material according to the reigns of the emperors, presenting it as he found it in his sources. The contents are as follows. After a detailed introduction which treats of Jesus Christ in Book 1, comes the history of the apostolic time to the capture of Jerusalem, Book 2. Then the following time to Trajan, Book 3. Books 4 and 5 treat of the 2nd century. Book 6 of the time from Severus to Decius. Book 7 extends to the outbreak of the persecution under Diocletian. Book 8 treats of this persecution. Book 9 brings the history to the victory over Maxentius in the west and over Maximinus in the east. Book 10 relates the reestablishment of the churches and the rebellion and conquest of Licinius. In its present form, the book was brought to a conclusion, or the work was brought to a conclusion, before the death of Crispus, July 326. And since Book 10 is dedicated to Paulinus of Tyre, who died before 325, at the end of 323 or in 324, this work required the most comprehensive preparatory studies. Must have occupied him for years. His collection of martyrdoms of the older period may have been one of these preparatory studies. The authenticity of Eusebius' church history is beyond dispute. Every new discovery shows anew the conscientious, careful, and intelligent use of the libraries of Caesarea and Jerusalem. Before he compiled his church history, Eusebius edited a collection of martyrdoms of the earlier period and a biography of Pamphilius. From a dogmatic, and there are other works that he did talked about, I'll skip over. From a dogmatic point of view, Eusebius stands entirely upon the shoulders of Origen. In other words, he was a follower of Origen. Like Origen, he started from the fundamental thought of the absolute sovereignty of God. God is the cause of all beings, he said. But he's not merely a cause. In him, everything good is included. From him, all life originates, and he's the source of all virtue. He is the highest God to whom Christ is subject as the second God. That ought to raise some theological Trinitarian controversy. We see what his bias and intention was in history. Now we'll look at his theology. See if Jerry the Fat would agree with it. God is the highest God to whom Christ is subject as the second God. God sent Christ into the world that it, the world, may partake of the blessing included in the essence of God. Christ is the only really good creature. He possesses the image of God and is a ray of the eternal light. But the figure of the ray is so limited by Eusebius that he expressly emphasizes the self-existence of Jesus. Eusebius was intent upon emphasizing the difference of the persons of the Trinity and maintaining the subordination of Jesus to God. He never calls Jesus Theos, because in all contrary attempts, he suspected polytheism or Sabellianism. Jesus is a creature of God, whose generation, it is true, took place before time. I'm not too sure that the Assemblies of God Trinitarian doctrine would buy all this, or the Southern Baptists. Jesus is in his activity the organ of God, the creator of life, the principle of every revelation of God, who in his absoluteness is enthroned above all the world. This divine logos assumed a human body without being altered thereby in any way in his being. The relation of the Holy Spirit within the Trinity, Eusebius explains similarly to that of the Son to the Father. No point of this doctrine is original with Eusebius. All is traceable to his teacher Origen. The lack of originality in his thinking shows itself in the fact that he never presented his thoughts in a system. He lacked a leading idea. Jerry the Fat. Except just keep his position secure. The limitations of Eusebius are closely connected with his gifts. His time, his contemporaries justly considered him its most learned man. A list of the sources he used for his church history would show what an amount of work had to be done to elaborate and sift the mass of material. But the learning of Eusebius cannot be measured with that of Origen. Origen was a productive spirit, Eusebius a compiler. Eusebius, however, distinguished himself by his carefulness. A man like Eusebius was not without weight in the time when barbarian nations began to invade the church in large masses. In the time which followed, nobody excelled him in learning. Church historians were able to copy him, but they could not supply his place. As a writer, he cannot be highly estimated. His style is without grace and brilliancy, his phraseology often monotonous, and his rhetoric cumbrous. Well, now when you know when we say Eusebius, now I'm sure a lot of you out there know all this backwards and forwards. But for those who don't, now when we talk about Eusebius, you'll know it's not a new horse. Wouldn't that be interesting to name a bunch of saddlebred horses after these early church fathers? Who are we looking for? Origen. Well, he's in here with Papias. What am I doing? We left Papias hanging there, didn't we? Origen. I warn you. These are the players. Religions always revolve around personalities. You take the Bible, personalities out of the Bible, it's a boring book. I mean, you have the snake, Balaam's ass. The brazen serpent. The temple, that's all boring. People make it, you know. Jacob and Tamar. Balaam's ass without Balaam is a monstrosity. Origen. O-R-I-G-E-N. Now we're back a little. 182 to 251 A.D. Start building yourself a timeline. I'll put it eventually on the board behind me when you're a little more familiar with the players, when I just write their names on and you learn all the code words. Origen, one of the most distinguished of the fathers of the early church, was born probably at Alexandria, about 182. Died at Caesarea not later than 251. There's his connection with Eusebius. Now, with this little thumbnail sketch of Eusebius, let you know he was the court theologian. It was self-destruct for him to not promote the establishment. He was the establishment voice. And by the 4th century, when the church has become the national church, do you think that he is going to write the history of the church in a way that says the establishment church got off course? Well, maybe they didn't get off course. The only question I'm asking, if they did, is Eusebius going to testify to that? I'm here as the court theologian, the expert the emperor relies on, attorney general of the state of Rome, speaks at my graduating classes. If anything needs to be cleaned up so the state is happy, doesn't matter whether it's in Maine or Charlotte, I'm the hitman for the Antichrist. I must keep peace between the church and the government, and I, above all, must maintain the respect of the government for the church. They don't change much, do they? Origen, one of the most distinguished of the fathers of the early church, was born probably at Alexandria by 182, died at Caesarea not later than 251. His full name was apparently Origenes Adamantius, and he received from his father Leonides through thorough instruction in the Bible and in elementary studies. Now at Alexandria, we have the church founded by Mark. But in 202, the outbreak of the persecution of Septimius Severus, robbed Origen of his father, whom he sought to follow into martyrdom, being prevented only by a ruse of his mother. The death of Leonides left the family of nine impoverished, their property being confiscated. Origen, however, was taken under the protection of a woman of wealth and standing. But as her household already included a heretic named Paul, not Paul the Apostle, the strictly Orthodox Origen seems, we're at 182 A.D., unless Paul was awful old. Origen seems to have remained with her but a short time. Since his father's teaching enabled him also to give elementary instruction, he revived in 203 the catechetical school at Alexandria, whose last teacher, Clement, was apparently driven out with a persecution. Now, we've got to go back to Clement and back to Mark eventually. But the persecution still raged, and the young teacher unceasingly visited the prisoners, attended the courts, and comforted the condemned, himself preserved from harm as if by a miracle. His fame and the number of his pupils increased rapidly, so that Demetrius, bishop of Alexandria, made him restrict himself to instruction in Christian doctrine alone. Origen, to be entirely independent, sold his library for a sum which netted him a daily income of 4 obols, about 12 cents, on which he lived by exercising the utmost frugalness. Teaching throughout the day, he devoted the greater part of the night to the study of the Bible and lived a life of rigid asceticism. Ascetic. This he carried to such an extent that, fearing that his position as a teacher of women, as well as men, might give ground for scandal to the heathen, he followed literally Matthew 19:12 and castrated himself. If thy members offend thee, cut them off. Protect your testimony to the heathen. Now, wouldn't the church, wouldn't the world today love all of us if we'd cut our elements off? They'd do it for us if we'd let them. Now we'll accept you as a preacher. Things don't change much. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Let's just leave him there in that condition, and Pappy is hanging where he's hanging. And if I don't... I've been... I've been going quite a while. I think it's time for you to tell me whether or not you want me to continue teaching on church history, or I'll just take all these books. You know, it's kind of hard to carry all these in every night. So you better get on the telephone and tell me if you want me to continue any of this. We'll leave old Papias hanging there in Origen in his misery. You sort of get the feeling, with all these people's martyrdom and everything, something happened to the glorious, happy gospel of grace. Something has happened. between that message that Paul could proclaim to Rome, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. My Lord, I'm ashamed of this. How do you like to raise your kids in this? You know, let me teach you how to use a knife. Toledo, Ohio, what does this guy believe? Well, what difference does that make? I'm helping you work out your beliefs. No offense intended, but it'll come out what I believe as we pursue these things together. But what I believe is not as important as the teaching that what it does to your beliefs. One thing, this guy smokes a cigar. I believe that's fun. All the preachers I've talked to say I can't speak in tongues unless I quit smoking. Now, that's interesting, because I got a book in my library written by an Assembly of God preacher, son of one of their presbyters and son of the head of one of their Bible schools. The title of the book is, He Smokes a Pipe and Speaks in Tongues. I like the way the guy talks. He reads the Bible and it makes sense. I'm in a wheelchair. One thing about this guy, he doesn't see me. He's not going to point at me and say, you're going to get out of that chair. I don't believe in that kind of stuff. Jesus said to the woman with the issue of blood, thy faith has made thee whole. I don't believe in second-class citizens because they're in wheelchairs in the Christian community. I believe that every one of you have a right to work your own faith out with God. I think if I ever get out of this chair, it'll be because God wants me to get out, not because I do. Well, the two of you might cooperate when it happens. But you and God got a right to work it out. Toledo, I'm a Catholic and also a major in history, and I find this man very interesting, okay? At the Bonaventure Hotel, visiting from Savannah, Georgia. Satellite. First-time watcher. Thank you, Doc Scott. You're preaching the right thing. I used to give money to Jerry Falwell, and I'll not do so any longer. Good for you. Be sending my tithes to Dr. Scott. Back in Georgia, they don't have volunteers on the phone. Well, back in Georgia, you can pick us up off satellite Westar 5 transponder 1X, and we always have people here on the phone, 24 hours a day. West Los Angeles, I'm out here watching, and this is interesting. I don't even know what time it is. Now, don't let that song make you throw your Rolex watches away. I don't believe Christians ought to get intimidated. Make one of your critics eat the watch, otherwise wear it. Now, I don't expect you to remember all the details of all these people's lives. I just want you to get a feel for something. That the formation of the church in the first four centuries, was the product of a tug-of-war ultimately resolved by an identity between the church and the government, the setting up an established church, and the elimination of that which disagreed. Now, there ain't too much different in the world. The ancients have stolen everything new. And that the church survived the first four centuries with all these strong personalities jockeying for position, banishing one another, will give you the hope it'll make it through this century. Well, let's take Origen a little further. During the reign of Caracalla, about 211 to 212, Origen paid a brief visit to Rome. But the relative laxity under the pontificate of Zephyrinus seems to have disillusioned him. And on his return to Alexandria, he resumed his teaching with zeal increased by the contrast. Now, we're starting to get a feel for the importance of Alexandria because of strong personalities there. The church founded by Mark. Caesarea moves up in importance. Antioch is still important. Rome is still important. Very important. But the school at Alexandria had far outgrown the strength of a single man. The pupils pressed eagerly for elementary instruction, and the baptized sought for interpretation of the Bible. Under these circumstances, Origen entrusted the teaching of the catechumens to Heraclius, the brother of the martyr Plutarch, his first pupil. His, Origen's, own interest became more and more centered in exegesis, scriptural interpretation, and he accordingly studied Hebrew, though there is no certain knowledge concerning his instructor in that language.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4. Thank you.